The following podcast deals with the controversial subject of marine mammals in captivity. In the 35-plus years that have passed since Marineland's closure, there's been a huge sea change in public opinion about this topic, and rightfully so. Throughout the course of this podcast, I hope to deal with these issues with honesty and sensitivity, while also acknowledging the tremendous awe, joy, and respect these animals have inspired in millions. And now, on with the show.
It was so incredible. Oh, it was spectacular. I mean, it was one of the most premier pieces of property, you know, in Southern California.
So it was that, there was that wonderment that you got, and, you know, just watching people on the stands, they're truly blown away by what they're seeing. You just didn't know what to expect. And I think no matter how many times you went, you were going to experience something different.
It was always about the animals. It wasn't about, we have to have a certain number of people attending the dolphin show or the pilot whale show. That was their mantra. The animals came first. That set the stage for, you know, the rest of us.
Yeah, there was a lot of work that we did to get people as close as we possibly could to the animals.
There were people, you know, kind of acting weird and running up and saying, "Hey, your window's broken. You know, the whale broke the window." And I'm going, "What?"
Bubbles was fully a diva at that point, and when she felt like doing things, she'd do things, and when she felt like being there and just hanging out, that's what happened.
One of the things that I loved about their relationship, the two of them, Orky and Corky, were like a married couple.
Well, it absolutely was a betrayal. I mean, you know, when they took Orky and Corky in the middle of the night.
We were all duped. You know, we were all told one thing, and then something else happened. And so when I say it felt like a murder, I mean, it really, really felt like something was taken away from you in an instant, in a tragic way. That, I mean, it was theft. You know?
He's on his way, just took in a big breath of air. You are about to see the largest whale in captivity. This is Orky up and touched it!
Welcome to LA's own Marineland. Over the next several episodes of this podcast, we'll travel back to a time when Marineland was the jewel of the Palos Verdes Peninsula and home to some of the most beautiful, intelligent, and charismatic performers the world has ever known. We'll meet pilot whales Bubbles and Bimbo, a host of chipper dolphins, and get eye to eye with the most famous pair of performing killer whales the world has ever known, Orky and Corky. We'll talk with nearly two dozen people who were closest to Marineland and helped create the park's unique magic. We'll remember how Marineland changed over four decades and multiple owners, and ultimately confront the craven business culture that led to the park's tragic demise. In our first episode of the podcast, we'll take a look at how Henry Harris was inspired to build Marineland after the success of Marine Studios in Florida. Later, we'll follow the exploits of renowned fisherman Frank Brocato, who bravely amassed the greatest underwater menagerie the world has ever seen. Lastly, we'll celebrate Marineland's opening day on August 28, 1954, where not everything went according to plan. So grab your popcorn, walk up the zigzag ramp past the oval fish tank, and make your way to the Killer Whale Coliseum to get a good seat before the show starts. But before you sit down, there's one warning. If you're listening to this podcast in the first five rows of the Killer Whale Coliseum, you will get wet. You may get soaked.
Seven-tenths of our world is covered with water. In Los Angeles, there's a place that overlooks this vast frontier. A place of wilderness. A place of drama. Hold your breath. It's Marineland, plummet into global oceans teeming with life. Go eye to glowing eye with predators of the deep. Venture into a realm as intriguing as outer space. All a touch closer at LA's own Marineland.
Our story begins 2,500 miles from Rancho Palos Verdes, California, in St. Augustine, Florida. In 1938, Douglas Burton, C.V. Whitney, and Ilya Tolstoy, grandson of writer Leo Tolstoy, opened Marine Studios, the world's first oceanarium. The facility was designed for Hollywood filmmakers to shoot underwater footage for motion pictures and newsreels. The large saltwater tanks with multiple underwater observation windows were the first of their kind to allow marine life to be studied and photographed in a controlled environment. In its first two decades, the underwater studios were used in films such as 1939's Marine Circus, 1953's The Sea Around Us, and the horror classic 1954's Creature from the Black Lagoon.
See underwater thrills never photographed before. See titanic underwater battles never dreamed of before in this most terrifying of the science fiction adventures.
The studios were an immediate success with the public, attracting over 30,000 visitors on its opening day to see two bottlenose dolphins, a sawfish, sea turtles, sharks, manta rays, and penguins. Burden and Tolstoy reached out to Henry Harris, an investment banker and senior partner at Harris Upham & Company in New York, to promote the oceanarium idea. Well aware of Marine Studio success, Harris thought that an oceanarium on the West Coast would be a big hit as well. In 1949, he assembled a group of investors and created Oceanarium, Inc. Marine Studios in Florida held stock in the company and agreed to help the West Coast project with scientific and technical assistance. The Korean War delayed the project, but it also gave Harris more time to secure additional funding to build his dream. After an extensive search of the California coast, Harris chose 65 acres on Long Point in Rancho Palos Verdes to build the project. A major reason was the quality of the ocean water in the area that would be pumped into the tanks. It also presented incredible views of Catalina Island and was a prime lookout spot to witness the majesty of the annual gray whale migration. I'll let our group of Marinelanders, that's what park employees called themselves, explain the beauty themselves. Elisa Mitchell worked at Marineland in guest relations and is a costume character in the 80s.
Imagine something like that being made today. You know, being tucked out away from things and in this beautiful, you know, Palos Verdes Peninsula area. You know, just remarkable, honestly. And so I'm, you know, sure had it more to do with the time that Palos Verdes was being built up, you know, because it was tucked away from Los Angeles enough that it kind of preserved, and it still does. I mean, Palos Verdes is not hugely different than when I grew up there, but, you know, right on the cliffs. And the thing that always I found funny is here's this beautiful space, and we're looking out over the ocean. Oh, God, one memory I have, I was not working as Professor Pelican, but I was working as an usher for the pilot whale show. And all of a sudden, we saw this massive pod of killer whales that were coming by. And so the show stopped. And then everybody just kind of stopped and watched this pod go by. And I felt like it was 50 or 60 killer whales. And it was so amazing. You know, looking out over the vast expanse of ocean and then the access down the cliffs to the water.
Bud Crames, Marineland killer whale trainer from 1984 to 87.
It was fantastic. It was, I mentioned in one of my quotes on my Facebook post that I loved the pilot whale show was the last show of the day. And then to sit there or stand there and look out over the ocean. Originally, we just had a small little area where we had our food, and we just look out over the ocean and watch the other animals. One day, saw a killer whale out there. Then we saw gray whales. you see sea lions all the time swimming by. And it's at the last show of the day, it was always Sun City time, and it was not a more beautiful place anywhere.
Ed Capel, Marineland's group sales manager from 79 to 87.
We had the most spectacular view. I was able to talk with clients on the phone, and at times I would see super pods of dolphins swimming by. I would see pods of orcas swimming by. I'd see gray whales swimming by. And it was just, you know, if you could think of the most amazing office to ever have, there's not one office that would ever rival where we were working. It was spectacular. I mean, it is just like, imagine a series of postcards. That's what we got to look at.
Linda Malik, Marineland's marketing director from 79 to 87.
We saw lots of whales. We had whale watchers, you know, counting. And they still do in San Vicente down by the lighthouse. We saw all kinds of creatures. We watched, there was one year there used to be a pier off the end of like where Nelson's is in Terranea now. And I remember John Corcoran and I standing there. It was some, you know, quasi tsunami. It was a huge storm. And we watched the storm just take out the pier. Was just being able to see, you know, nature at its finest, you know, both in the, you know, sort of artificial world of marine land within the facility and externally out to the ocean. It was a beautiful sight for the park.
Tracy Belting worked at the park from 76 to 87, ending in the animal care department.
Oh, man, it was so amazing. It was so incredible. I mean, just seriously, on our lunch breaks, we would walk around the perimeter of the cliffs, and there were the sea lions. There was a rookery of breeding sea lions down on the cliffs, and that you could watch, and it was spectacular. I mean, it was one of the most premier pieces of property, you know, in Southern California, and we got to go to work there every single day. I mean, it was spectacular. It was gorgeous.
Michael Jett, manager of general services in Baja Reef from 77 to 87.
Pilot Whale Show was probably the closest show to the cliffs on the west side of the park. If there were killer whales or gray whales or anything that the public could see in the ocean itself while there was a show going on, if at all possible, the trainers would actually stop the show and then allow the guests in the stadium to walk out of the stadium, walk out over towards the cliffs and see, you know, dolphins, whales, whatever, in their natural environment, swimming up and down the coast. The trainers were so in tune with just sea mammals in general that in itself was a show. Those were great times when things like that would happen.
That's when you get way more than you paid for as a guest.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jim Roop, director of live entertainment from 1980 to 84.
Every day was beautiful, of course. And especially the winter time, because when the sun would set early and the sun sets over that water, over those cliffs, were just spectacular. I have tons of photographs of that because you can never get enough of it. The way the sun came up in the morning and just sort of that the sun just kind of followed everything across the park as it headed toward the ocean. You'd stand on the cliffs down by where the old galley restaurant used to be and where for a while there were the headquarters for our live shows department before we got the new facilities up above the parking lot. You'd just be standing down there and gray whales would migrate by. You know, the sound of the waves crashing against the rocks below the cliffs, the seagulls that you can hear, I mean, they're kind of a pain once in a while. There's not one piece per person that worked there that was not greeted by a seagull, if you know what I mean, at some point. But it was...
By the way, that's been a theme that everybody has talked about is the seagull poop.
As Jim points out, there was a natural danger in the area. Seagulls. Elisa Mitchell,
this is not a kind story, but there's seagulls everywhere, of course. And, you know, they take food and that kind of stuff, but there was also poop on people. And so you'd be standing next to some poor kid who just got nailed, you know, not sure what to do with that.
Fred Schaefer, Marineland warehouse manager from 1976 to 87.
Oh, yeah. Well, not everyone's gotten pooped on. I never got pooped on by a seagull, but it does happen. And, you know, they say it's good luck. And in fact, it's kind of funny because they ended up, our merchandise department had a shirt that had the Marineland Seagull Society. And it was all like you have a shirt on and it's all like covered with bird poop, you know. So it does happen enough, yes. I think more people got their food stolen off their tray by seagulls than got pooped on.
Jim Roop.
I got it a number of times. Yeah. It becomes a badge of honor, except when it hits you in the head. That only happened to me once. That was pretty bad. You know, the shoulders, the shoes, that kind of thing was usually you're walking around the park and it's kind of, you kind of walk into it. They don't target you. You just kind of walk into it. They're just going to do what they're going to do when they're flying by. But if you're standing still, you know, I found out there's a good chance you're going to get it dropped right on your head. And sure enough, right on the side of my head, down past my ear. That was pretty bad.
Roger Couture, who worked in janitorial from 75 to 79.
Mike Inawa from Hawaii. A lot of us were seasonal. Mike became a regular guy. But, you know, a lot of us were just kids from, I was at Rolling Hills High School, and a lot of kids were from Palos Verdes High School. And then somewhere last, Mike Inawa. So at the top of the slides, you remember we put the slides in?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at the top of the slides, and Mike, we went surfing together, Mike just gives me a linebacker block and throws me 3 feet away into the railing. And then as he does that, the flock of seagulls drops their bomb load and just splatters the whole upper deck of the slides. And Mike goes, "Thank you." I'm like, "Oh my God, I owe you so much." I mean, it was a total dive bomb, total like 10 seagulls all at one time.
Mark Grindle worked in guest relations in the early 80s, and his brother worked at the park as well.
Yeah, there's, you know, first off, my brother has a great story. One day he came home from work, and he had a big cut on his forehead and on his scalp. And I asked him what happened, and he said he got attacked by a seagull. A seagull came down and just got him right across the head. The ironic thing about it was the night before we had just watched Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. So it totally freaked my brother Michael out. Because he goes, you know, it was so weird. I went to work that morning and there's so many seagulls and pigeons flying around Marineland. He goes, I was thinking about it all day long and all of a sudden I got hit in the head by this seagull and, you know, it just made me freak out. I thought they were all going to do what they did in the movie. I know the birds were always a problem at Marineland, the seagulls, and they had to try and come up with various ways to scare them off of this, away from the stands in the stadium, because they would go to the bathroom all over the place and have to wash it down. And I know they had these big guns that just let out these big air bursts, like loud pops, to try and scare them away. They had that bird barrier everywhere because, to keep the birds from nesting up in the rafters and everything. That was always a challenge for them with the birds.
In 1953, the land for the Oceanarium was purchased from the Palos Verdes Land Corporation. The plans for the Oceanarium were conceived by the legendary architectural firm of Pereira and Luckman. Bringing them on the project would prove to be a masterstroke. William Pereira was a handsome and charismatic architect who designed some of California's most iconic landmarks, including San Francisco's Transamerica Pyramid, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the Geisel Library at UCSD, and the Disneyland Hotel. Anyone who's ever flown into the Los Angeles International Airport has had their breath taken away by its iconic landmark, the Theme Building, which features 135-foot-high parabolic arches. Pereira's mid-century style is evident in the two massive three-story Oceanarium tanks and the Galley West restaurant he designed for Marineland. The mid-50s atomic look is the signature style of the Los Angeles population boom. It's a timeless, simple, yet sophisticated aesthetic that conjures up a feeling of optimism and progress. A testament to the style's timeless appeal are Disneyland and Dodger Stadium. Both were built in the same era, with a similar aesthetic, and neither place has moved away from it. In fact, it seems that over the years, both places have undergone renovations that accentuate the mid-century vibe. Construction of the park began on June 1, 1953, a little less than 15 months before its grand opening. Marineland was budgeted at $3 million, but it would eventually balloon to $3.5 million. The centerpiece of the Marineland project were two large connected oceanariums. One, a 640,000-gallon circular tank, 80 feet in diameter and 22 feet deep, with seating for 1,500 viewers. The circular tank drew fresh water from the Pacific Ocean that was unheated. In its early years, the tank housed dolphins and later pilot whales. In 1969, it would be renamed the Killer Whale Coliseum for its most famous residents, Orky and Corky. The other tank was oval-shaped and dubbed the Giant Fishbowl, that was 100 feet long by 50 feet wide, 22 feet deep, and held 500,000 gallons of water heated to 72 degrees to keep the local marine life at an ideal temperature. In addition to the two massive tanks, there were various jewel box aquariums where visitors can see marine life requiring special treatment, such as octopi, which required cooler temperatures. The Coral Atoll was a touch tank where visitors could get up close and personal with the fish. Mark Grindle from Guest Relations helped educate guests who entered the atoll, but sometimes he needed a little help himself.
There was a small indoor aquarium where there was different tropical fish swimming around, and you would have to describe the different fish to people who asked. And it was all dark in there. It was kind of an entrance to go around the first level of the giant fish tank and also to the killer whale tank for that viewing area. The thing I remember about it is that most of us who worked in guest relations were 18, 19, 20 years old, and we couldn't tell a Garibaldi from a perch. And so, but one of the girls who worked there, I think her name was Pam, she was an artist, and she actually drew color pictures of each of the different types of fish, and then she labeled them and put a little bit of background of each one and put it all into a book that we could use. So, you know, that was really helpful because people will come up to you and say, what kind of fish is that? You know, and without this book, my answer would be, well, that's a redfish. I don't know. So, but it was all tropical, you know. So I'm sure you had like angelfish, or I think the other ones are bluefish, and you always, of course, the lemon sharks were popular. I think there were a couple of small rays in there as well. They always asked about the shark. What kind of shark was that? They would ask if, you know, are those kind of fish, you know, just off the coast here, which they weren't. They would ask if they bite, do they eat each other? That was a big question from the kids. How come the sharks don't eat the other fish? And, you know, it's because they're well fed. So I think those are the most common questions that you always got. Yeah, you always got somebody who would try to reach in and grab one of the sharks by the tail, or just, you know, get a little bit too aggressive with sticking their hands in. But yeah, you would just get people who would just try and be really aggressive and try and catch the fishes and or the fish. And this could have been, you know, a five-year-old and even adults. So, you know, when that happened, we had to ask them to stop. And if they wouldn't, we had to just get in touch with security.
Visitors can reach the top of both tanks by walking up one of four exterior ramps. The ramps would take guests in and out of the underwater viewing areas, where they could see the amazing collection of marine life through continuous double-glazed viewing windows. Both tanks were fed water from the ocean through a subterranean collecting drain, a perforated cement pipe buried in the beach about 2,500 feet from the main oceanarium emptied water into a sump. The water was then lifted 125 feet by two 100 horsepower pumps. After the water was treated to slow algae growth, it was introduced to the large tanks through the bottom via jets that caused enough of a whirlpool to provide self-cleaning. The filtered seawater could be pumped into the tanks at a rate of 2,000 gallons per minute. Greg Long, son of Jim Long, who worked at the park from the mid-50s to 1970 as its original announcer and vice president.
The pumping equipment was down the road towards the cave, as I recall. It was just behind, you know, in metal boxes, so I never saw that. They had all the piping ran actually above, well, it was in tunnels behind, like, a lot of the offices inside the main building. And so you could walk through this tunnel and see all these huge pipes back there. That was pretty interesting. But the water processing plant itself was actually visible to the public. One of the ramps going up to the ocean side of the main building, it went up about, I think, three levels or so. And sort of the ramp sort of went around this water purification plant, processing plant, and it was very industrial looking, and the water just flowing through. And they filmed a lot of, well, several TV shows and movies there, and that was one of their standard places that they would show some sort of, you know, industrial organization, something like that. If it wasn't Marineland itself, that was the background, but that area, it had a very kind of weird look to it. But it was just fun to see the water pouring out and getting processed, however they did that.
In addition to the Oceanarium building, the architects designed the Marineland Restaurant and Porpoise Room, a mid-mod cocktail lounge that presented incredible views of the entire Pacific Ocean. Guests could also stay at the Marineland Inn, a 10-room hotel on the property. The inn presented unobstructed views of the Pacific, and a single room cost just $8 a night. If you wanted to splurge, a double was $10. These days, a room at the Terranera Resort, which is currently on the property, will cost you about 40 times that amount. The architecture at Marineland was incredible, the location unsurpassed. But now Oceanarium Inc. had to put some real work to find the true stars of the park, the marine life, and it wasn't going to be easy. The man who got the job of filling 1 million gallons worth of tanks was renowned commercial fisherman Frank Brocato, captain of Marineland's chief vessel, the Geronimo. He was assisted by his godson, Boots Calandrino, and the park's first curator, Ken Norris. Larry Clark, head trainer from 1959 to 1969.
Frank and Boots and Benny Falcone Benny came in probably about 65 and joined the collecting team. They were good. They were good old Italian boys. You didn't see much of them because they were always out on the Geronimo, you know, either picking up fish or working on a boat or collecting dolphins or whales. And yeah, I went out with them once. Asked them, you know, hey, can I go out on the boat with you? Yeah, you know. So they finally, I bugged them enough times. They said, okay, you know, show up at such a time. Frank Mercado said, now one thing you got to learn, the toilets on the boat are for women only. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you got to take a dump, you got to take a pee, you do it off of the stern. I mean, the old Italian boy, they didn't miss any words, you know. the toilet was immaculate, and it was for women only. When women came aboard, if they went out, because they would periodically have news people or something like that would go out with them or something. And so if there was a woman that happened to go out on the boat, they would have a restroom for her. They knew it was clean. I peed over the stern and that was it. Thank God I didn't have to go poop.
The following is a dramatization based on an interview in the Daily Breeze from 1987. Frank Brocato is played by voice actor and comedian Steve Shaw.
They sent me out to find fish to fill about 1 million gallons of Oceanarium, but the holding tank back at the park wasn't built yet. So I found this 25,000-gallon tank off Catalina Island.
26 miles out to sea, right?
Yes, I see your radio works. I'm more of a Dean Martin guy. Anyway, the job wasn't going to be easy. They told me and Boots to go out and find the biggest collection of marine life ever assembled, but the Pacific isn't a pet store. They said if you find a whale while you're out there, reel it in. So I found this 25,000-gallon boiler from an old aquarium on Catalina. We scraped out the rust and filled it with water and fish. Job done.
But it wasn't that easy.
No. After all our work filling the boiler, the pump broke and all the fish died.
Back out to sea?
So we filled it up again. But then a storm hit and a backup pump kicked in that was tied to a sewage line on the island and all the fish were dead. Now we had 2 months to get something together or the park was going to be nothing but water and a few goldfish on opening day. We picked another site that was part of a harbor on Catalina that was sealed off with a net. But this wasn't perfect either. One day we came back to dump off some barracuda. I looked in and said, "Where the hell are all the fish?" Then I heard this loud squawk and saw an eagle swoop down and land on a post. They would just sweep in and carry off the fish. It was like we were bringing in breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day.
But Frank and his team would wind up bringing enough marine life to make a dazzling display on opening day. As it turned out, the huge holding tank built at the park could never hold water and was never used. You may have noticed this show has no advertising. Well, kind of like PBS, we're relying on our listeners to support our efforts to preserve Marineland's history through this podcast, which has taken countless hours to produce. There are two ways you can help. First, you can make a donation to the show through PayPal by clicking on the donate button on our website at marinelandpodcast.com. That's marinelandpodcast.com. Or you can take a deeper dive into Marineland's history by becoming a Patreon subscriber. At patreon.com/marinelandpodcast, you can listen to full interviews with 19 people closest to the park. You'll also get the Patreon exclusive episode, Making Marineland, where I share the backstory of how this podcast came to be. It's all just $5.99 a month. Get started at patreon.com/marinelandpodcast. Thanks for your support. Now back to the show. Marineland of the Pacific officially opened to the public on August 28, 1954. It's worth noting that this was a little less than a year before Disneyland opened 40 miles away in Anaheim, California, on July 17, 1955.
Marineland, the world's largest oceanarium, opens tomorrow.
A newspaper ad from August 27th read,
"See eye to eye with thousands of captive sea creatures living in natural surroundings in gigantic tanks. It's thrilling, fascinating, and educational. Bring the family."
And they did. Nearly 15,000 people attended Marineland's grand opening. But as they say in today's speech, it was a bit of a soft launch. When the park opened, the Marineland restaurant and inn were still under construction, and the dolphins in the 1,500-seat arena had yet to be trained. Trainer Dave Brown told the Evening Standard it would take about 6 months before they'd be able to perform. So in the 640,000-gallon circular tank, audiences were treated to feeding exhibitions. However, not everything was a letdown. Brocato's menagerie of fish was incredible. The park opened with 4 dolphins, 100 sharks, a 75-pound electric ray, 16 giant turtles from Mexico, several giant eagle rays, seahorses from Florida, an exotic tropical fish from Hawaii and the San Francisco Bay. The star of the oval tank was a giant octopus. At the grand opening, Marineland's president, Henry Harris, gave a dedicatory address, and the colors were presented by the United States Coast Guard. Ten-year-old Susanna Blood of Downey, California, was renamed Alice of Marineland for the occasion and tossed the first fish into the oceanarium for the porpoise feeding show. The park drew 25,000 people over its opening weekend, but curator Ken Norris felt the main attraction, the dolphin show, failed to impress. He noted that they did no more than feed from their trainer's hand and occasionally poke their heads out of the water. But for the thousands of visitors, it was their first experience seeing these animals close up. Greg Long.
It was how people learned about whales and dolphins back in those days. There just wasn't a lot of information out there. So it was the first interaction or viewing or anything like that many people had of many of these sea creatures. So it did what it needed to do for the time, I guess.
Guests also enjoyed the feeding show in the big oval tank. Virginia Mason worked as a pearl diver in the 1970s.
Well, I remember Jake, the older gentleman who would be, he was the diver who would get in the big dive suit. Oh. And he would go down and feed the fish. That was a show as well. So it was like one of those dive suits from, what's the show with...
Sea Hunt.
Yeah. Thanks. And he'd put that on, and it had a microphone, and he would talk to the audience, and they would come around all three levels, through the windows, and they could hear him. He had somebody else who worked there with him. I think his name was Jay, and the two of them would alternate. But he was such a nice, nice older man. I don't know. He's probably in his 60s, probably my age, but he seemed so much older.
Sensing that the park's small group of white-sided dolphins was an underwhelming main attraction, curator Ken Norris reached out to Marine Studios in Florida, who lent four Atlantic bottlenose dolphins to the park, named Frankie, Floyd, Mabel, and Myrtle. It was the first time that dolphins have ever flown in a plane. They were boarded in a Flying Tiger's DC-3 in small tanks that contained saltwater. The flight took 14 hours because the pilots were told to fly low, because it was assumed that as deep divers, the dolphins would have trouble with the altitude. Within a few months of Marineland's opening, Norris developed a training program that taught the dolphins to jump out of the water, respond to their names, and, quote, sing for their audiences.
Now these three got together about a week ago and they formed a little singing group. They'd like to sing for you today. Smitty will direct, and they're going to sing It's a Great Day for Singing. There they are, the Aquatic Carusos.
Greg Long.
And they had several dolphins in there. I believe their names were Patty, Kathy, and Debbie. And they would just all jump out at the same time and jump over a pole they had. They would extend over the water. And they would always say, oh, here comes Patty, Kathy, and Debbie. And they come jumping out and jump over there. That was nice. I actually ended up owning some chickens a few years ago, and I named them after those dolphins. So I had chickens named after the dolphins. Yeah.
Eventually, head trainer Larry Clark would teach the dolphins how to do more advanced tricks, like jumping through hoops of fire.
So to back things up a little bit, so when they taught the dolphin to jump through a flaming hoop, it seems like it would be against every instinct in the dolphin to go near fire. Or did they just not understand fire? How did they get that behavior to happen?
You take a hula hoop and you submerge it underwater, and you take a stick with an alligator clip and you put a smelt or a mackerel on it. You know, after a while, you know, the animal's coming over and it'll you get it to swim through the hoop, feeding it off the stick, then gradually raising it, the hula hoop up. When it wants to go over it, it's going to have to jump. And so then they put a regular hoop on a metal hoop with asbestos wrapped around it, then put gasoline on it and lit it on fire. And the animal was so used to going through the hoop before it was ever lit that it was no big deal. You give them the command to go through and they would automatically just jump through. Then when you lit it on fire, they didn't even seem, you know, start, you just put a little bit of gas on it. Animal didn't even, I don't think, realize it. And then you could just increase it a little bit more. And there was never enough on there to, you know, hurt the animal. They just did jump through it.
So that trick never went wrong.
No, it never did. Not while I was there.
Although the park's strong opening foretold a great future, administrative and technical problems prevented it from earning a profit over its first 2 years. The park would need something big. Something really exciting to get Angelenos to jump in their cars and drive out to the cliffs of Palos Verdes. Norris, Bracato, and recently hired general manager Bill Monahan knew they needed a whale. That's all for now. But before you exit the gates, be sure to get your hand stamped so you can come back through the turnstile without having to buy another ticket. On the next episode of LA's Own Marineland, the park reaches new heights after a new star becomes a worldwide phenomenon. LA's Own Marineland was written, produced, and hosted by Todd Perry. That's me. But this wouldn't be possible without the help of a wonderful group of Marinelanders who shared their incredible stories. This episode features the voice talents of Steve Shaw and Mark Chambers. For more information, references, and to support the show, visit MarinelandPodcast.com and follow us on Twitter at MarinelandLAPod. Please be sure to sign up for our Patreon page, where you can learn even more about the history of Marineland by listening to full interviews with 19 people closest to the park. You'll also get the Patreon-exclusive episode, Making Marineland, that tells the backstory of how this podcast came to be. Get over 15 hours of fun for just $5.99 a month. Get started at patreon.com/marinelandpodcast. That's patreon.com/marinelandpodcast.